word in written form centuries before. For all Rayford's education and intelligence, he felt he had been a fool. Now he couldn't get enough of this information, though it was becoming clear that the odds were against the person living until the glorious appearing of Christ. The sixth seal judgment, Bruce continued, is God pouring out his wrath against the killing of his saints. This will come in the form of a worldwide earthquake so devastating that no instruments would be able to measure it. It will be so bad that people will cry out for rocks to fall on them and put them out of their misery. Several in the room began to weep. The seventh seal introduces the seven trumpet judgments, which will take place in the second quarter of this seven-year period. The second 21 months, Rayford clarified. Right. I don't want to get into those tonight, but I warn you they are progressively worse. I want to leave you with a little encouragement. You remember we talked briefly about the two witnesses, and I said I would study that more carefully? Revelation chapter 11, verses 3 through 14, makes it clear that God's two special witnesses, with supernatural power to work miracles, will prophesy 1,260 days clothed in sackcloth. Anyone who tries to harm them will be devoured. No rain will fall during the time that they prophesy. They will be able to turn water to blood and to strike the earth with plagues whenever they want. Satan will kill them at the end of 3.5 years, and their bodies will lie in the street of the city where Christ was crucified. The people they have tormented will celebrate their deaths, not allowing their bodies to be buried. But after 3.5 days, they will rise from the dead and ascend to heaven in a cloud while their enemies watch. God will send another great earthquake. A tenth of the city will fall, and 7,000 people will die. The rest will be terrified and give glory to God. Rayford glanced around the office as people murmured among themselves. They had all seen it, the report of the two crazy men preaching about Jesus at the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. "Is that them?" someone asked. "Who else could it be?" Bruce said. "It has not rained in Jerusalem since the disappearances. These men came out of nowhere. They have the miraculous power of saints like Elijah and Moses, and they call each other Eli and Moshe. At this moment, the men are still preaching."
"The witnesses?"
"Yes, the witnesses. If any one of us still harbored any doubts or fears, not sure what has been going on, these witnesses should allay them all. I believe these witnesses will see hundreds of thousands of converts, the 144,000 who will preach Christ to the world. We're on their side. We have to do our parts." Buck reached Hattie Durham at her home number Tuesday night. "So you're coming through New York?" he said.
"Yes," she said. "And I'd love to see you and maybe get to meet a VIP.
"You mean other than me?"
"Cute," she said. "Have you met Nikolai Carpathia yet?"
"Of course."
"I knew it! I was just telling someone the other day that I'd love to meet that man."
"No promises, but I'll see what I can do. Where should we meet?"
"My flight gets in there about 11, and I have a 1 o'clock appointment in the Pan Con Club. But if we don't get back in time for that, it's okay. I don't fly out till morning, and I didn't even tell the guy I would meet him at 1.
"Another guy?" Buck said. "You've got some weekend planned."
"It's nothing like that," she said. "It's a pilot who wants to talk to me about something, and I'm not sure I even want to listen. If I'm back and have time, fine, but I haven't committed to it. Why don't we meet at the club and see where we want to go from there?"
"I'll try to arrange the meeting with Mr. Carpathia, probably at his hotel." It was late Tuesday night when Chloe changed her mind and agreed to go to New York with her father. "I can see you're not ready to be out without me," she said, embracing him and smiling. "It's nice to be needed." "To tell you the truth," he said, "I'm going to insist on a meeting with Hattie, and I want you there."
"For her protection or yours?"
"Not funny.
I've left her a message insisting that she see me in the Pan Con Club at JFK at 1 p.m. Whether she will or not, I don't know. Either way, you and I will get some time together.
Daddy, time together is all we've had.
I'd think you'd be tired of me by now. That'll never happen, Chloe. Early Wednesday morning, Buck was summoned to the office of Stanton Bailey, publisher of Global Weekly. In all his years of award-winning work, he had been in there only twice, once to celebrate his Hemingway War Correspondence Award, and once on a Christmas tour of what the employees enviously called Mahogany Row. Buck ducked in to see Steve first, only to be told by Marge that he was in with the publisher already. Her eyes were red and puffy.
"What's happening?" he said.
"You know I can't say anything," she said. "Just get in there." Buck's imagination ran wild as he entered the suite of offices inhabited by the brass. He hadn't known Plank had been summoned, too. What could it mean? Were they in trouble for the shenanigans they had pulled Monday night? Had Mr. Bailey somehow found out the details of the London business and how Buck had escaped? And he certainly hoped this meeting would be over in time for his appointment with Hattie Durham. Bailey's receptionist pointed him to the publisher's outer office, where his secretary raised one brow and waved him in.
"You're not going to announce me?" he joked.
She smirked and returned to her work. Buck knocked quietly and carefully pushed open the door. Plank sat with his back to Buck and didn't turn. Bailey didn't rise, but beckoned him in.
"Sit right there next to your boss," Bailey said, which Buck thought an interesting choice of words. Of course, it was true, but that was not how Steve was usually addressed.
Buck sat and said, "Steve." Steve nodded, but kept looking at Bailey.
"Couple of things, Williams," Bailey began, "before I get down to business. You're cleared of everything overseas, right?"
Buck nodded.
"Yes, sir. There should never have been any doubt."
"Well, of course there shouldn't, but you were lucky. I guess it was smart to make it look like whoever was after you got you, but you made us think that for a while, too, you know."
"Sorry, I'm afraid that was unavoidable."
"And you wound up giving them ammunition to use against you if they wanted to bust you for some reason."
"I know, that surprised me."
"But you got it taken care of."
"Right.
How?"
"Sir?"
"What part of how don't you understand? How did you extricate yourself? We got word there were witnesses who say you did it."
"There must have been enough others who knew the truth. Tompkins was a friend of mine. I had no reason to kill him, and I sure didn't have the means. I wouldn't have the slightest idea how to make a bomb or transport it or detonate it."
"You could have paid to have it done."
"But I didn't. I don't run in those circles, and if I did, I wouldn't have had Alan killed."
"Well, the news coverage is all vague enough that none of us look bad. Just looks like a misunderstanding."
"Which it was."
"Of course it was. Cameron, I asked to see you this morning because I have just accepted one of the least welcome resignations I have ever received."
Buck sat silent, his head spinning.
"Steve here tells me this will be news to you, so let me just drop it on you. He is resigning immediately to accept the position of International Press Secretary to Nikolai Carpathia. He's received an offer we can't come close to, and while I don't think it's wise or a good fit, he does, and it's his life. What do you think about that?"
Buck couldn't contain himself.
"I think it stinks. Steve, what are you thinking of? You're going to move to Romania?"
"I'll be headquartered here, Buck, at the plaza."
"Nice. I'll say."
"Steve, this isn't you. You're not a PR guy. Carpathia is no ordinary political leader. Tell me you weren't on your feet cheering Monday."
"I was, but..."
"But nothing. This is the opportunity of a lifetime. Nothing else would have lured me from this job."
Buck shook his head.
"I can't believe it. I knew Carpathia was looking for somebody, but..."
Steve laughed. "Tell the truth, Buck. He offered it to you first, didn't he?"
"No.
He as much as told me he did. Well, he didn't. Matter of fact, I recommended Miller from Seaboard. Plank recoiled and shot a glance at Bailey.
Really?
Yeah, why not? He's more the type.
Buck, Steve said. Eric Miller's body washed up on Staten Island last night. He fell off the ferry and drowned.
Well, Bailey said summarily, enough of that ugly business. Steve has recommended you to replace him.
Buck was still reeling from the news about Miller, but he heard the offer.
Oh, please, he said. You're not serious.
You wouldn't want the job? Bailey asked. Shape the magazine, determine the coverage, still write the top stories yourself?
Sure you would. By policy, it would almost double your salary, and if that's what it took to get you to agree, I'd guarantee it.
That's not it, Buck said. I'm too young for the job I've got now.
You don't believe that, or you wouldn't be as good at it as you are.
Yeah, but that's the sentiment of the staff.
What else is new? Bailey roared. They think I'm too old. They thought Steve was too laid back. Others thought he was too pushy. They'd complain if we brought in Mother Teresa.
I thought she was missing.
You know what I mean. Now how about it?
I could never replace Steve, sir. I'm sorry. People may have complained, but they knew he was fair and in their corner.
And so would you be.
But they'd never give me the benefit of the doubt. They'd be in here undermining me and complaining from day one.
I wouldn't allow it. Now, Buck, this offer isn't going to sit on the table indefinitely. I want you to take it, and I want to be able to announce it immediately.
Buck shrugged and looked at the floor.
Can I have a day to think about it?
24 hours. Meantime, don't say a word to anybody. Plank, anybody else know about you?
Only Marge.
We can trust her. She'll never tell a soul. I had a 3-year affair with her and never worried about anybody finding out.
Steve and Buck flinched.
Well, Bailey said, you never knew, did you?
No, they said in unison.
See how tight-lipped she is?
He waited a beat.
I'm kidding, boys, I'm kidding.
He was still laughing as they left the office.
Chapter 18
Buck followed Steve to his office.
Did you hear about those kooks at the Wailing Wall? Steve said.
Like I'm interested in that right now, Buck said.
Yeah, I saw them, and no, I don't want to cover that story.
Now what is this?
This will be your office, Buck. Marge will be your secretary.
You can't possibly think I would want your job. First off, we can't afford to lose you. You're the only sane person here.
Including you?
Especially including me.
You must have really run interference for me with Bailey if he thinks I would be anything but a powder keg in your job.
Your job? You think I should take it?
You bet I do. I suggested no one else, and Bailey had no other candidates.
He'd have all the candidates he wanted if he just announced the opening. Who wouldn't want this job besides me?
If it's such a plum, why don't you want it?
I'd feel as if I were sitting in your chair.
So order your own chair.
You know what I mean, Steve. It won't be the same without you. This job isn't me.
Look at it this way, Buck. If you don't take it, you have no say in who becomes your new boss. Anybody on this staff you want to work for?
Yeah, you.
Too late. I'm gone tomorrow.
Now seriously, you want to work for Juan?
You wouldn't recommend him.
I'm not going to recommend anybody but you. You don't take it, you're on your own. You take your chances, you'll wind up working for a colleague who already resents you. How many hot assignments you think you'll get then?
If I got dumped on, I'd threaten to go to Time or somewhere. Bailey wouldn't let that happen.
You turn down a promotion, he might make it happen. Rejecting advancement is not a good career move.
I just want to write.
Tell me you haven't thought you could run this editorial department better than I do at times.
A lot of times.
Here's your chance.
Bailey would never stand for my assigning myself all the best stuff. Make that a condition of your acceptance. If he doesn't like it, it's his decision, not yours.
For the first time, Buck allowed a sliver of light to enter his head about the possibility of taking the executive editor job. I still can't believe you'd leave to become a press secretary, Steve, even for Nikolai Carpathia.
Do you know what's in store for him, Buck?
A little.
There's a sea of power and influence and money behind him that will propel him to world prominence so quick it'll make everyone's head spin. Listen to yourself. You're supposed to be a journalist. I hear myself, Buck. I wouldn't feel this way about anybody else. No U.S. president could turn my head like this. No U.N. secretary general. You think he'll be bigger than that? The world is ready for Carpathia, Buck. You were there Monday. You saw it. You heard it. Have you ever met anyone like him?
No.
You never will again, either. If you ask me, Romania is too small for him. Europe is too small for him. The U.N. is too small for him.
What's he gonna be, Steve? King of the world? Steve laughed.
That won't be the title, but don't put it past him. The best part is he's not even aware of his own presence. He doesn't seek these roles. They're thrust upon him because of his intellect, his power, his passion.
You know, of course, that Stonegal is behind him.
Of course, but he'll soon supersede Stonegal in influence because of his charisma. Stonegal can't be too visible, and so he will never have the masses behind him. When Nikolai comes to power, he'll in essence have jurisdiction over Stonegal.
Wouldn't that be something?
I say it'll happen sooner than any of us can imagine, Buck.
Except you, of course.
That's exactly how I feel. You know I've always had good instincts. I'm sure I'm sitting on one of the greatest rises to power of anyone in history, maybe the greatest, and I'll be right there helping it happen.
And what do you think of my instincts, Steve? Steve pressed his lips together.
Other than your writing and reporting, your instincts are the things I most envy.
Then rest easy. My gut feeling is the same as yours, and except that I could never be anybody's press secretary, I almost envy you. You are uniquely positioned to enjoy the ride of your life. Steve smiled.
We'll keep in touch. You'll always have access to me and to Nikolai.
I can't ask for more than that. Marge interrupted on the intercom without signaling first.
Hit your TV, Steve, or whoever's TV it is now.
Steve smiled at Buck and switched it on. CNN was broadcasting live from Jerusalem, where two men had tried to attack the preachers at the Wailing Wall. Dan Bennett was on the scene for CNN. It was an ugly and dangerous confrontation for what many here are calling the two heretical prophets, known only as Moshe and Eli, Bennett said. We know these names only because they have referred to each other thus, but we have been unable to locate anyone who knows any more about them. We know of no last names, no cities of origin, no families or friends. They have been taking turns speaking, preaching, if you will, for hours and continuing to claim that Jesus Christ is the Messiah. They have proclaimed over and over that the great worldwide disappearances last week, including many here in Israel, evidenced Christ's rapture of his church. A heckler asked why they had not disappeared if they knew so much. The one called Moshe answered, and I quote, "Where we come from and where we go, you cannot know." His companion Eli was quoted, "In my father's house are many mansions," apparently a New Testament quotation attributed to Christ. Steve and Buck exchanged glances. Surrounded by zealots most of the day, the preachers were finally attacked just moments ago by two men in their mid-20s. Watch the tape as our cameras caught the action. You can see the two at the back of the crowd working their way to the front. Both are wearing long hooded robes and are bearded. You can see that they produce weapons as they emerge from the crowd. One has an Uzi automatic weapon and the other a bayonet-type knife that appears to have come from an Israeli-issue military rifle. The one wielding the knife surges forward first, displaying his weapon to Moshe, who had been speaking. Eli, behind him, immediately falls to his knees, his face toward the sky. Moshe stops speaking and merely looks at the man, who appears to trip. He sprawls while the man with the Uzi points the weapon at the preachers and appears to pull the trigger.
There is no sound of gunfire as the Uzi apparently jams and the attacker seems to trip over his partner and both wind up on the ground. The group of onlookers has backed away and run for cover, but watch again closely as we rerun this. The one with the gun seems to fall of his own accord. As we speak, both attackers lie at the feet of the preachers who continue to preach. Angry onlookers demand help for the attackers, and Moshe is speaking in Hebrew. Let's listen, and we'll translate as we go. He's saying, "Men of Zion, pick up your dead. Remove from before us these jackals who have no power over us." A few from the crowd approach tentatively, while Israeli soldiers gather at the entrance to the wall. The zealots are waving them off. Eli is speaking. "You who aid the fallen are not in danger unless you come against the anointed ones of the Most High," apparently referring to himself and his partner. The fallen attackers are being rolled onto their backs, and those attending them are weeping and shouting and backing away. "Dead! Both dead," they are saying. And now the crowd seems to want the soldiers to enter. They are clearing the way. The soldiers are, of course, heavily armed. Whether they will try to arrest the strangers, we don't know. But from what we saw, the two preachers neither attacked nor defended themselves against the men now on the ground. Moshe is speaking again. "Carry off your dead, but do not come nigh to us," says the Lord God of hosts. This he has said with such volume and authority that the soldiers quickly have checked pulses and carried off the two men. "We will report any word we receive on the two who attempted to attack the preachers here at the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. At this moment, the preachers have continued their shouting, proclaiming, 'Jesus of Nazareth, born in Bethlehem, King of the Jews, the Chosen One, Ruler of all nations.'" In Israel, Dan Bennett for CNN. Marge and a few others on the staff had drifted into Steve's office during the telecast. "If that doesn't beat all," one said. "What a couple of kooks." "Which two?" Buck said. "You can't say the preachers, whoever they are, didn't warn them." "What's going on over there?" someone else asked. "All I know," Buck said, "is that things happen there that no one can explain." Steve raised his eyebrows. "If you believe in the virgin birth, that's been true for centuries." Buck rose. "I've got to get to JFK, he said. "What are you going to do about the job?" "I've got 24 hours, remember? Don't use them all. Answer too quick, you look eager. Too slow, you look indecisive." Buck knew Steve was right. He was going to have to accept the promotion just to protect himself from other pretenders. He didn't want to be obsessed with it all day. Buck was glad for the diversion of seeing Hattie Durham. His only question now was whether he would recognize her. They had met under most traumatic circumstances. Rayford and Chloe arrived in New York just after noon on Wednesday and went directly to the Pan Con Club to wait for Hattie Durham. "I'm guessing she won't show," Chloe said. "Why?" "Because I wouldn't if I were her." "You're not her, thank God." "Oh, don't put her down, Dad. What makes you any better?" Rayford felt awful. Chloe was right. Why should he think less of Hattie just because she seemed dim at times? That hadn't bothered him when he had seen her only as a physical diversion. And now, just because she had been nasty with him on the phone and never acknowledged his last invitation to meet today, he had categorized her as less desirable or less deserving. "I am no better," he conceded. "But why wouldn't you show up if you were her?" "Because I'd have an idea of what you'd have in mind. You're going to tell her you no longer have feelings for her, but that now you care about her eternal soul." "You make that sound cheap." "Why should it impress her that you care about her soul when she thinks you used to be interested in her as a person?" "That's just it, Chloe. I wasn't ever interested in her as a person." "She doesn't know that. Because you were so circumspect and so careful, she thought you were better than most men who would just come right out and hit on her. I'm sure she feels bad about Mom, and she probably understands that you're not in any state of mind to start a new relationship. But it can't make her day to be sent away like it was just as much her fault." It was, though.
No, it wasn't, Dad. She was available. You shouldn't have been, but you were giving signals like you were. In this day and age, that made you fair game.
He shook his head. Maybe that was why I was never good at that game. I'm glad for Mom's sake that you weren't.
So you think I shouldn't, what, let her down easy or tell her about God?
You've already let her down, Daddy. She guessed what you were going to say, and you confirmed it. That's why I say she won't come. She's still hurt. Probably mad.
Oh, she was mad, all right.
Then what makes you think she's going to be receptive to your heaven pitch?
It's not a pitch. Anyway, doesn't it prove I care about her in a genuine way now?
Chloe went and got a soft drink. When she returned and sat next to her father, she put a hand on his shoulder.
I don't want to sound like a know-it-all, she said. I know you're more than twice my age, but let me give you an idea how a woman thinks, especially someone like Hattie, okay?
I'm all ears.
Does she have any religious background?
I don't think so.
You never asked? She never said?
Neither of us ever gave it much thought.
You never complained to her about Mom's obsession like you sometimes did with me?
Come to think of it, I did. Of course, I was trying to use that to prove that your mother and I weren't communicating.
But Hattie didn't say anything about her own thoughts about God?
Rayford tried to remember.
You know, I think she did say something supportive or maybe sympathetic about your mom.
That makes sense. Even if she had wanted to come between you, she might have wanted to be sure you were the one putting the wedge between yourself and Mom, not her.
I'm not following.
That's not my point anyway. What I'm getting at is that you can't expect someone who's not even a church person to give a rip about heaven and God and all that. I'm having trouble dealing with it, and I love you, and I know it's become the most important thing in your life. You can't assume she has any interest, especially if it comes to her as a sort of a consolation prize.
For
losing your attention.
But my attention is purer now, more genuine.
To you, maybe. To her, this is going to be much less attractive than the possibility of having someone who might love her and be there for her.
That's what God will do for her.
Which sounds real good to you. I'm just telling you, Dad, it's not going to be something she wants to hear right now.
So what if she does show up? Should I not talk to her about it?
I don't know. If she shows, that might mean she's still hoping there's a chance with you.
Is there?
No. Then you owe it to her to make that clear. But don't be so emphatic, and don't choose that time to try to sell her on...
Stop talking about my faith as something I'm trying to sell or pitch.
Sorry. I'm just trying to reflect how it's going to sound to her.
Rayford had no idea what to say or do about Hattie now. He feared his daughter was right, and that gave him a glimpse of where her mind was, too. Bruce Barnes had told him that most people are blind and deaf to the truth until they find it. Then it makes all the sense in the world. How could he argue? That's what had happened to him.
Hattie had rushed up to Buck when he arrived at the club around 11. His anticipation of any possibilities dissipated when the first thing out of her mouth was, "So, am I gonna get to meet Nikolai Carpathia?" When Buck had originally promised to try to introduce her to Nikolai, he hadn't thought it through. Now, after hearing Steve rhapsodize about the prominence of Carpathia, he felt trivial calling to ask if he could introduce a friend, a fan. He called Dr. Rosenzweig. "Doc, I feel kind of stupid about this, and maybe you should just say no, that he's too busy. I know he's got a lot on his plate, and this girl is no one he needs to meet."
"It's a girl?"
"Well, a young woman. She's a flight attendant."
"You want them to meet a flight attendant?"
Buck didn't know what to say. That reaction was exactly what he had feared. When he hesitated, he heard Rosenzweig cover the phone and call out for Carpathia.
"Doc, no, don't ask him."
But he did. Rosenzweig came back on and said,
"Nikolai says that any friend of yours is a friend of his.
He has a few moments, but only a few moments, right now.
Buck and Hattie rushed to the plaza in a cab. Buck realized immediately how awkward he felt and how much worse he was about to feel. Whatever reputation he enjoyed with Rosenzweig and Carpathia as an international journalist would forever be marred. He would be known as the hanger-on who dragged a groupie up to shake hands with Nikolai. Buck couldn't hide his discomfort, and on the elevator he blurted, "He really has only a second, so we shouldn't stay long." Hattie stared at him. "I know how to treat VIPs, you know," she said. "I often serve them on flights." "Of course you do. I mean, if you're embarrassed by me, or..." "It's not that at all, Hattie. If you think I won't know how to act..." "I'm sorry. I'm just thinking of his schedule." "Well, right now, we're on his schedule, aren't we?" He sighed. "I guess we are." "Why, oh why, do I get myself into these things?" In the hallway, Hattie stopped by a mirror and checked her face. A bodyguard opened the door, nodded at Buck, and looked Hattie over from head to toe. She ignored him, craning her neck to find Carpathia. Dr. Rosenzweig emerged from the parlor. "Cameron," he said, "a moment, please." Buck excused himself from Hattie, who looked none too pleased. Rosenzweig pulled him aside and whispered, "He wonders if you could join him alone first." "Here it comes," Buck thought, flashing Hattie an apologetic look and holding up a finger to indicate he wouldn't be long. "Carpathia's gonna have my neck for wasting his time." He found Nikolai standing a few feet in front of the TV watching CNN. His arms were crossed, his chin in his hand. He glanced Buck's way and waved him in. Buck shut the door behind him, feeling as if he had been sent to the principal's office, but Nikolai didn't mention Hattie. "Have you seen this business in Jerusalem?" he said. Buck said he had. "Strangest thing I have ever seen." "Not me," Buck said. "No?" "I was in Tel Aviv when Russia attacked." Carpathia kept his eyes on the screen as CNN played over and over the attack on the preachers and the collapsing of the would-be assassins. "Yes," he mumbled. "That would have been something akin to this. Something unexplainable." "Heart attacks, they say." "Pardon? The attackers are dead of heart attacks." "I hadn't heard that." "Yes, and the Uzi did not jam. It is in perfect working order." Nikolai seemed transfixed by the images. He continued to watch as he talked. "I wondered what you thought of my choice for press secretary." "I was stunned."
"I thought you might be."
"Look at this. The preachers never touched either of them. What are the odds? Were they scared to death? Was that it?" The question was rhetorical. Buck didn't answer.
"Hm-hm-hm," Carpathia exclaimed, the least articulate Buck had ever heard him. "Strange indeed. There's no question Planck can do the job, though, do you agree?"
"Of course.
I hope you know you've crippled the weekly."
"Ah, I have strengthened it. What better way to have the person I want at the top?"
Buck shuddered, relieved when Carpathia looked away from the TV at last. "This makes me feel just like Jonathan Stonegal, maneuvering people into positions." He laughed, and Buck was pleased to see that he was kidding. "Did you hear what happened to Eric Miller?" Buck asked.
"Your friend from Seaboard Monthly?"
"No, what?"
"Drowned last night."
Carpathia looked shocked.
"You do not say. Dreadful."
"Listen, Mr. Carpathia, Buck, please, call me Nikolai." "I'm not sure I'll be comfortable doing that. I just wanted to apologize for bringing this girl up to meet you. She's just a flight attendant and..."
"Nobody is just anything," he said, taking Buck's arm. "Everyone is of equal value, regardless of their station."
Carpathia led Buck to the door, insisting he be introduced. Hattie was appropriate and reserved, though she giggled when Carpathia kissed her on each cheek. He asked her about herself, her family, her job. Buck wondered if he had ever taken a Carnegie course on how to win friends and influence people.
"Cameron," Dr. Rosenzweig whispered. "Telephone."
Buck took it in the other room. It was Marge.
"I hoped you'd be there," she said. "You just got a call from Carolyn Miller, Eric's wife. She's pretty shook up and really wants to talk to you."
"I can't call her from here, Marge."
"Well, get back to her as soon as you get a minute."
"What's it about?"
"I have no idea, but she sounded desperate. Here's her number."
When Buck reemerged, Carpathia was shaking hands with Hattie and then kissed her hand. "I am charmed," he said. "Thank you, Mr. Williams. And Miss Durham, it shall be my pleasure should our paths cross again."
Buck ushered her out and found her nearly overcome. "Some guy, huh?" he said.
"He gave me his number,"
she said, nearly squealing.
"His number?"
Hattie showed Buck the business card Nikolai had handed her. It showed his title as President of the Republic of Romania, but his address was not Bucharest, as one would expect. It was the Plaza Hotel, his suite number, phone number, and all. Buck was speechless. Carpathia had penciled in another phone number, not at the Plaza, but also in New York. Buck memorized it.
"We can eat at the PanCon Club," Hattie said. "I don't really want to see this pilot at one, but I think I will, just to brag about meeting Nikolai."
"Oh, now it's Nikolai, is it?" Buck managed, still shaken by Carpathia's business card.
"Trying to make someone jealous?"
"Something like that," she said.
"Would you excuse me a second?" he said. "I need to make a call before we head back."
Hattie waited in the lobby while Buck ducked around the corner and dialed Carolyn Miller. She sounded horrible, as if she had been crying for hours and hadn't slept, which was no doubt true.
"Oh, Mr. Williams, I appreciate your calling."
"Of course, ma'am, and I'm so sorry about your loss. I..."
"You remember that we've met?"
"I'm sorry, Mrs. Miller. Refresh me."
"On the presidential yacht 2 summers ago.
"Certainly, forgive me.
I just didn't want you to think we'd never met. Mr. Williams, my husband called me last night before heading for the ferry. He said he was tracking a big story at the Plaza and had run into you."
"True."
"He told me a crazy story about how you two had a wrestling match or something over an interview with this Romanian guy who spoke at..."
"Also true." "It wasn't anything serious, ma'am. Just a disagreement. No hard feelings."
"That's how I took it. But that was the last conversation I'll ever have with him, and it's driving me crazy. Do you know how cold it was last night?"
"Nippy, as I recall," Buck said, puzzled at her abrupt change of subject.
"Cold, sir. Too cold to be standing outside on the ferry, wouldn't you say?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"And even if he was, he's a good swimmer. He was a champion in high school."
"All due respect, ma'am, but that had to be, what, 30 years ago?
"But he's still a strong swimmer. Trust me, I know."
"What are you saying, Mrs. Miller?"
"I don't know," she shouted, crying. "I just wondered if you could shed any light. I mean, he fell off the ferry and drowned? It doesn't make any sense."
"It doesn't to me either, ma'am, and I wish I could help, but I can't."
"I know," she said. "I was just hoping."
"Ma'am, is someone with you, watching out for you?"
"Yes, I'm okay. I have family here."
"I'll be thinking of you."
"Thank you."
Buck could see Hattie in a reflection. She seemed patient enough. He called a friend at the telephone company. "Alex, do me a favor. Can you still tell me who's listed if I give you a number?"
"Long as you don't tell anybody, I'm doing it. You know me, man.
Go ahead." Buck recited the number he had memorized from the card Carpathia had given Hattie. Alex was back to him in seconds, reading off the information as it scrolled onto his computer screen.
"New York, UN, Administrative Offices, Secretary General's Office, Unlisted Private Line, Bypasses Switchboard, Bypasses Secretary. Okay?"
"Okay, Alex, I owe you."
Buck was lost. He couldn't make any of this compute. He jogged out to Hattie.
"I'll be another minute," he said. "Do you mind?"
"No, as long as we can get back by one. No telling how long that pilot will wait. He's got his daughter with him."
Buck turned back to the phones, glad he had no interest in competing with Carpathia or this pilot for Hattie Durham's affection. He called Steve. Marge answered, and he was short with her.
"Hey, it's me. I need Plank right away."
"Well, have a nice day yourself," she said, and rang him through.
"Steve," he said quickly, "your boy just made his first mistake."
"What are you talking about, Buck?"
"Is your first job going to be announcing Carpathia as the new Secretary General?"
Silence.
"Steve, what's next?"
"You're a good reporter, Buck. The best. How did this get out?"
Buck told him about the business card.
"Phew! That doesn't sound like Nikolai. I can't imagine it was an oversight. Must have been on purpose."
"Maybe he's assuming this Durham woman is too ditzy to figure it out," Buck said, "or that she wouldn't show me. But how does he know she won't call the number too soon and ask for him there?"
"As long as she waits until tomorrow, Buck, he'll be all right."
"Tomorrow?
You can't use this, all right? Are we off the record?"
"Steve, who do you think you're talking to?
Are you working for Carpathia already?
You're still my boss.
You don't want me to run with something, you just tell me, remember?"
"Well, I'm telling you.
The Kalahari Desert makes up much of Botswana, where Secretary General Nagumo is from. He returns there tomorrow a hero, having become the first leader to gain access to the Israeli fertilizer formula."
"And how did he do that?"
"By his stellar diplomacy, of course.
And he cannot be expected to handle the duties of both the UN and Botswana during this strategic moment in Botswana history, right, Steve?"
"And why should he, when someone is so perfectly suited to step right in? We were there Monday, Buck. Who's going to oppose this?"
"Don't you?"
"I think it's brilliant."
"You're going to be a perfect press secretary, Steve, and I've decided to accept your old job."
"Good for you. Now you'll sit on this till tomorrow, you got it?"
"Promise. But will you tell me one more thing?"
"If I can, Buck."
"What did Eric Miller get too close to? What lead was he tracking?" Steve's voice became hollow, his tone flat.
"All I know about Eric Miller," he said, "is that he got too close to the railing on the Staten Island ferry."
Chapter 19. Rayford watched Chloe as she wandered around the Pan Con Club, then stared out the window. He felt like a wimp. For days he had told himself not to push, not to badger her. He knew her. She was like him. She would run the other way if he pushed too hard. She had even talked him into backing off of Hattie Durham, should Hattie show up. What was the matter with him? Nothing was as it was before or would ever be again. If Bruce Barnes was right, the disappearance of God's people was only the beginning of the most cataclysmic period in the history of the world. And here I am, Rayford thought, worried about offending people. I'm liable to not offend my own daughter right into hell. Rayford also felt bad about his approach to Hattie. He had dealt with his own wrong in having pursued her, and he regretted having let her on. But he could no longer treat her with kid gloves, either. What scared him most was that it seemed, from what Bruce was teaching, that many people would be deceived during these days. Whoever came forward with proclamations of peace and unity had to be suspect. There would be no peace. There would be no unity. This was the beginning of the end, and all would be chaos from now on. The chaos would make peacemakers and smooth talkers only more attractive. And to people who didn't want to admit that God had been behind the disappearances, any other explanation would salve their consciences. There was no more time for polite conversation, for gentle persuasion. Rayford had to direct people to the Bible, to the prophetic portions. He felt so limited in his understanding. He had always been an erudite reader, but this stuff from Revelation and Daniel and Ezekiel was new and strange to him.
Frighteningly, it made sense. He had begun taking Irene's Bible with him everywhere he went, reading it whenever possible. While the first officer read magazines during his downtime, Rayford would pull out the Bible.
"What in the world?" he was asked more than once.
Unashamed, he said he was finding answers and direction he had never seen before. But with his own daughter and his friend? He had been too polite. Rayford looked at his watch, still a few minutes before 1 o'clock. He caught Chloe's eye and signaled that he was going to make a phone call. He dialed Bruce Barnes and told him what he had been thinking.
"You're right, Rayford. I went through a few days of that, worried what people would think of me, not wanting to turn anybody off. It just doesn't make sense anymore, does it?"
"No, it doesn't. Bruce, I need support. I'm going to start becoming obnoxious, I'm afraid. If Chloe wants to laugh or run the other way, I'm going to force her to make a decision. She'll have to know exactly what she's doing. She'll have to face what we've found in the Bible and deal with it. I mean, the two preachers in Israel alone are enough to give me the confidence that things are happening exactly the way the Bible said they would.
Have you been watching this morning?"
"From a distance here in the terminal. They keep rerunning the attack."
"Rayford, get to a TV right now."
"What?"
"I'm hanging up, Ray. See what happened to the attackers and see if that doesn't confirm everything we read about the two witnesses."
"Bruce, go, Rayford, and start witnessing yourself with total confidence."
Bruce hung up on him. Rayford knew him well enough, despite their brief relationship, to be more intrigued than offended. He hurried to a TV monitor where he was stunned to hear the report of the deaths of the attackers. He dug out Irene's Bible and read the passage from Revelation Bruce had spoken from. The men in Jerusalem were the two witnesses preaching Christ. They had been attacked, and they didn't even have to respond. The attackers had fallen dead, and no harm had been done to the witnesses. Now, on CNN, Rayford watched as crowds surged into the area in front of the Wailing Wall to listen to the witnesses. People knelt, weeping, some with their faces on the ground. These were people who had felt the preachers were desecrating the holy place. Now it appeared they were believing what the witnesses said. Or was it merely fear? Rayford knew better. He knew that the first of the 144,000 Jewish evangelists were being converted to Christ before his eyes. Without taking his gaze from the screen, he prayed silently. "God, fill me with courage, with power, with whatever I need to be a witness. I don't want to be afraid anymore. I don't want to wait any longer. I don't want to worry about offending. Give me a persuasiveness rooted in the truth of your word. I know it is your spirit that draws people, but use me. I want to reach Chloe. I want to reach Hattie. Please, Lord, help me." Buck Williams felt naked without his equipment bag. He would feel ready to work only when he had his cellular phone, his tape recorder, and his new laptop. He asked the cabbie to stop by the Global Weekly office so he could pick up the bag. Hattie waited in the cab, but she told him she wasn't going to be happy if she missed her appointment. Buck stood by the window of the cab.
"I'll just be a minute," he said.
"I thought you weren't sure whether you wanted to see this guy."
"Well, now I do, okay? Call it revenge or rubbing it in or whatever you want, but it's not often you get to tell a captain you've met someone he hasn't."
"You talking about Nikolai Carpathia or me?"
"Very funny. Anyway, he has met you."
"This is the captain from that flight where you and I met?"
"Yes. Now hurry."
"I might want to meet him."
"Go."
Buck called Marge from the lobby. "Could you meet me at the elevator with my equipment bag? I've got a cab waiting here."
"I would," she said, "but both Steve and the old man are asking for you."
What now? He wondered. Buck checked his watch, wishing the elevator was faster. Such was life in the skyscrapers. He grabbed his bag from Marge, breezed into Steve's office, and said,
"What's up? I'm on the run."
"Boss wants to see us."
"What's it about?" Buck said as they headed down the hall.
Eric Miller, I think. Maybe more. You know, Bailey wasn't thrilled at my short notice. He only agreed to it thinking that you'd jump at the promotion, because you know where everything is and what's planned for the next couple of weeks. In Bailey's office, the boss got right to the point. I'm going to ask you two some pointed questions, and I want some quick and straight answers. A whole bunch of stuff is coming down right now, and we're going to be on top of every bit of it. First off, Plank, rumors are flying that Wangari Ngumo is calling a press conference for late this afternoon, and everybody thinks he's stepping down as Secretary General. Really? Plank said. Don't play dumb with me, Bailey growled. It doesn't take a genius to figure what's happening here. If he's stepping down, your guy knows about it. You forget I was in charge of the African Bureau when Botswana became an associate member of the European Common Market. Jonathan Stonegal has his fingers all over that, and everybody knows he's one of this Carpathia guy's angels. What's the connection? Buck saw Steve pale. Bailey knew more than either of them expected. For the first time in years, Steve sounded nervous, almost panicky. I'll tell you what I know, he said. But Buck guessed there was more he didn't say. My first assignment tomorrow morning is to deny Carpathia's interest in the job. He's going to say he has too many revolutionary ideas, and that he would insist on almost unanimous approval on the parts of the current members. They would have to agree to his ideas for reorganization, a change of emphasis, and a few other things. Like what? I'm not at liberty to... Bailey rose, his face red. Let me tell you something, Plank. I like you. You've been a superstar for me. I sold you to the rest of the brass when nobody else recognized you had what it takes. You sold me on this punk here, and he's made us all look good. But I paid you six figures long before you deserved it because I knew someday it would pay off, and it did. Now, I'm telling you that nothing you say here is going to go past these walls, so I don't want you holding out on me. You brats think that because I'm 2 or 3 years from the pasture, I don't still have contacts, don't have my ear to the ground. Well, let me tell you, my phone's been ringing off the hook since you left here this morning, and I've got a gut feeling something big is coming down. Now, what is it?
Who's been calling you, sir? Plank said.
Well, first off, I get a call from a guy who knows the vice president of Romania. Word over there is the guy has been asked to be prepared to run the day-to-day stuff indefinitely. He's not going to become the new president because they just got one, but that tells me Carpathia expects to be here a while. Then people I know in Africa tell me Ngumo has some inside track on the Israeli formula, but that he's quietly not happy about the deal requiring him to step down from the UN. He's going to do it, but there's going to be trouble if everything doesn't go as promised. Then, of all things, I get a call from the publisher at Seaboard Monthly wanting to talk to me about how you, Cameron, and his guy that drowned last night were working the same angle on Carpathia, and whether I think you're going to mysteriously get dead, too. I told him that, as far as I knew, you were working on a general cover story about the guy, and that we were going to be positive. He said his guy had intended to take a slightly different approach, you know, zig when everybody else is zagging. Miller was doing a story on the meaning behind the disappearances, which I know you were planning for an issue or two from now. How that ties in with Carpathia and why it might paint him in a dark light, I don't know. Do you? Buck shook his head. I see them as two totally different pieces. I asked Carpathia what he made of what happened, and everybody has heard that answer. I didn't know that's what Miller was working on, and I sure wouldn't have thought he would somehow link Carpathia with the disappearances. Bailey sat back down. To tell you the truth, when I first took the call from the guy at Seaboard, I thought he was calling for a reference on you, Cameron. I was thinking if I lose both these turkeys the same week, I'm taking early retirement. Can we get that stuff out of the way before I make Plank tell me what he knows?
What stuff? Buck said.
You looking to leave?
I'm not.
You taking the promotion?
I am.
Good. Now, Steve, what else is Carpathia gonna push for before he accepts the UN job?
Plank hesitated and looked as if he were considering whether he should tell what he knew.
"I'm telling you, you owe me," Bailey said. "Now, I don't intend to use this. I just want to know. Cameron and I have to decide which story we're going to push first. I want to get him onto the one that interests me most, the one about what was behind the disappearances. Sometimes I think we get too snooty as a news magazine and we forget that everyday people out there are scared to death, wanting to make some sense of all this. Now, Steve, you can trust me. I already told you I won't tell anyone or compromise you. Just run it down for me. What does Carpathia want? And is he gonna take this job?"
Steve pursed his lips and began reluctantly. "He wants a new Security Council set up, which will include some of his own ideas for ambassadors."
"Like Todd Cawthron from England?" Buck said.
"Probably temporarily. He's not entirely pleased with that relationship, as you may know." Buck suddenly realized that Steve knew everything.
"And?" Bailey pressed.
"He wants Nagumo personally to insist on him as his replacement. A large majority vote of the representatives and two other things that, frankly, I don't think he'll get. Militarily, he wants a commitment to disarmament from member nations, the destruction of 90% of their weapons, and the donation of the other 10% to the UN.
For peacekeeping purposes," Bailey said. "Naive, but logical sounding. You're right, he probably won't get that. What else?"
"Probably the most controversial and least likely. The logistics alone are incredible. The cost, the everything."
"What?"
"He wants to move the UN."
"Move it?" Steve nodded. "Where?"
"It sounds stupid."
"Everything sounds stupid these days," Bailey said.
"He wants to move it to Babylon."
"You're not serious."
"He is.
I hear they've been renovating that city for years. Millions of dollars invested in making it, what, New Babylon?"
"Billions.
Think anyone will agree to that?"
"Depends how bad they want him." Steve chuckled. "He's on the Tonight Show tonight.
He'll be more popular than ever.
He's meeting right now with the heads of all these international groups that are in town for unity meetings."
"What does he want with them?"
"We're still confidential here, right?" Steve asked.
"Of course."
"He's asking for resolutions supporting some of the things he wants to do. The 7-year peace treaty with Israel in exchange for his ability to broker the desert fertilizer formula. The move to New Babylon. The establishment of one religion for the world, probably headquartered in Italy."
"He's not going to get far with the Jews on that one."
"They're an exception. He's going to help them rebuild their temple during the years of the peace treaty. He believes they deserve special treatment."
"And they do," Bailey said. "The man is brilliant. Not only have I never seen someone with such revolutionary ideas, but I've also never seen anyone who moves so quickly."
"Aren't either of you the least bit shaky about this guy?" Buck said. "It looks to me like people who get too close wind up eliminated."
"Shaky?" Bailey said. "Well, I think he's a little naive, and I'll be very surprised if he gets everything he's asking for, but then he's a politician. He won't couch these as ultimatums, and he can still accept the position even if he doesn't get them. It sounds like he may have run roughshod over Nagumo, but I think he had Botswana's best interest in mind. Carpathia will be a better UN chief, and he's right. If what happened in Israel happens in Botswana, Nagumo needs to stay close to home and manage the prosperity."
"Shaky? No. I'm as impressed with the guy as you two are. He's what we need right now. Nothing wrong with unity and togetherness at a time of crisis." "What about Eric Miller?"
"I think people are making too much of that. We don't know that his death wasn't just what it appeared and was only coincidental with his run-in with you and Carpathia. Anyway, Carpathia didn't know what Miller was after, did he?"
"Not that I know of," Buck said, but he noticed that Steve said nothing.
Marge buzzed in on the intercom.
"Cameron has an urgent message from a Hattie Durham. Says she can't wait any longer."
"Oh, no," Buck said.
"Marge, apologize all over the place for me.
Tell her it was unavoidable and that I'll either call her or catch up with her later.
Bailey looked disgusted. Is this what I can expect from you on work time, Cameron?
Actually, I introduced her to Carpathia this morning, and I want her to introduce me to an airline captain in town today for part of that story on what people think happened last week.
I make no bones about it, Cameron, Bailey said. Let's do the big Carpathia story next issue, then follow up with the theories behind the vanishings after that. If you ask me, that could be the most talked-about story we've ever done. I thought we beat Time and everybody else on our coverage of the event itself. I liked your stuff, by the way. I don't know that we'll have anything terribly fresh or different about Carpathia, but we have to give it all we've got. Frankly, I love the idea of you running the point on this coverage of all the theories. You must have one of your own.
I wish I did, Buck said. I'm as in the dark as anybody. What I'm finding, though, is that people who have a theory believe in it totally.
Well, I've got mine, Bailey said, and it's almost eerie how close it matches Carpathia's or Rosenzweig's or whoever. I've got relatives who believe the space alien stuff. I've got an uncle who thinks it was Jesus, but he also thinks Jesus forgot him.
Ha!
I think it was natural, some kind of phenomenon where all our high-tech stuff interacted with the forces of nature and we really did a number on ourselves. Now come on, Cameron. Where are you on this?
I'm in the perfect position for my assignment, he said. I haven't the foggiest.
What are people saying?
The usual. A doctor at O'Hare told me he was sure it was the rapture. Other people have said the same. You know our Chicago bureau chief,
Lucinda Washington. It's going to be your job to find a replacement for her, you know. You'll have to go there, get the lay of the land, get acquainted. But you were saying?
Her son believed she and the rest of the family were taken to heaven.
So how'd he get left behind?
I'm not sure what the deal is on that, Buck said. Some Christians are better than others or something. That's one thing I'm going to find out before I finish this piece. This flight attendant who just called, I'm not sure what she thinks, but she said the captain she's meeting today thinks he has an idea.
An airline captain, Bailey repeated. That would be interesting, unless his idea is the same as the other scientific types. Well, carry on. Steve, we're going to announce this today. Good luck, and don't worry about anything you've said here finding its way into the magazine, unless we get it through other sources. We're agreed on that, aren't we, Williams?
Yes, sir, Buck said.
Steve didn't look so sure.
Buck ran to the elevator and called information for the number of the Pan Con Club. He asked them to page Hattie, but when they couldn't locate her, he assumed she hadn't arrived yet or had gone out with her pilot friend. He left a message to have her call him on his cellular phone, then headed that way in a cab just in case. His mind was whirring. He agreed with Stanton Bailey that the big story was what had been behind the disappearances, but he was also becoming suspicious of Nikolai Carpathia. Maybe he shouldn't be. Maybe he should focus on Jonathan Stonegal. Carpathia should be smart enough to see that his elevation could help Stonegal in ways that would be unfair to his competitors. But Carpathia had pledged that he would deal with both Stonegal and Todd Cawthron, knowing full well they were behind illegal deeds. Did that make Carpathia innocent? Buck certainly hoped so. He had never in his life wanted to believe more in a person. In the days since the disappearances, he'd hardly had a second to think for himself. The loss of his sister-in-law and niece and nephew tugged at his heart almost constantly, and something made him wonder if there wasn't something to this rapture thing. If anybody in his orbit would be taken to heaven, it would have been them. But he knew better than that, didn't he? He was Ivy League educated. He had left the church when he left the claustrophobic family situation that threatened to drive him crazy as a young man. He had never considered himself religious, despite a prayer for help and deliverance once in a while. He had built his life around achievement, excitement, and, he couldn't deny it, attention.
He loved the status that came with having his byline, his writing, his thinking in a national magazine. And yet there was a certain loneliness in his existence, especially now with Steve moving on. Buck had dated and had considered escalating a couple of serious relationships, but he had always been considered too mobile for a woman who wanted stability. Since the clearly supernatural event he had witnessed in Israel with the destruction of the Russian Air Force, he had known the world was changing. Things would never again be as they had been. He wasn't buying the space alien theory of the disappearances, and while it very well could be attributed to some incredible cosmic energy reaction, who or what was behind that? The incident at the Wailing Wall was another unexplainable bit of the supernatural. Buck found himself more intrigued by the whys and wherefores story, as he liked to think of it, than even the rise of Nikolai Carpathia. As taken as he was with the man, Buck hoped against hope that he wasn't just another slick politician. He was the best Buck had ever seen, but was it possible that Dirk's death, Alan's death, Eric's death, and Buck's predicament were totally independent of Carpathia? He hoped so. He wanted to believe a person could come along once in a generation who could capture the imagination of the world. Could Carpathia be another Lincoln, a Roosevelt, or the embodiment of Camelot that Kennedy had appeared to some? On impulse, as the cab crawled into the impossible traffic at JFK, Buck plugged his laptop modem into his cellular phone and brought up a news service on his screen. He quickly called up Eric Miller's major pieces for the last 2 years and was stunned to find he had written about the rebuilding and improvement in Babylon. The title of Miller's series was New Babylon, Stonegal's Latest Dream. A quick scan of the article showed that the bulk of the financing came from Stonegal banks throughout the world, and of course there was a quote attributed to Stonegal. Just coincidence. I have no idea the particulars of the financing undertaken by our various institutions. Buck knew that the bottom line with Nikolai Carpathia would have nothing to do with Mwangati Nagumo or Israel or even the new Security Council. To Buck, the litmus test for Carpathia was what he did about Jonathan Stonegal once Carpathia was installed as Secretary General of the United Nations. Because if the rest of the UN went along with Nikolai's conditions, he would become the most powerful leader in the world overnight. He would have the ability to enforce his wishes militarily if every member were disarmed and UN might were increased. The world would have to be desperate for a leader they trusted implicitly to agree to such an arrangement. And the only leader worth the mantle would be one with zero tolerance for a murderous, behind-the-scenes schemer like Jonathan Stonegal. Chapter 20. Rayford and Chloe Steele waited until 1:30 in the afternoon, then decided to head for their hotel. On their way out of the Pan Con Club, Rayford stopped to leave a message for Hattie in case she came in.
"We just got another message for her," the girl at the counter said. "A secretary for a Cameron Williams said Mr. Williams would catch up with her here if she would call him when she got in."
"When did that message come?" Rayford asked.
"Just after one."
"Maybe we'll wait a few more minutes."
Rayford and Chloe were sitting near the entrance when Hattie rushed in. Rayford smiled at her, but she immediately seemed to slow as if she had just happened to run into them.
"Oh, hi,"
she said, showing her identification at the counter and taking her message. Rayford let her play her game. He deserved it.
"I really shouldn't have come to see you," she said, after being introduced to Chloe. "And now that I'm here, I should return this call. It's from the writer I told you about. He introduced me to Nikolai Carpathia this morning."
"You don't say." Hattie nodded, smiling.
"And Mr. Carpathia gave me his card. Did you know he's going to be named People Magazine's Sexiest Man Alive?"
"I had heard that, yes. Well, I'm impressed. Quite a morning for you, wasn't it? And how is Mr. Williams?"
"Very nice, but very busy. I'd better call him. Excuse me."
Buck was on an escalator inside the terminal when his phone rang. "Well, hello yourself," Hattie said.
"I am so sorry, Miss Durham."
"Oh, please," she said. "Anybody who leaves me in Midtown Manhattan in an expensive cab can call me by my first name. I insist."
"And I insist on paying for that cab."
"I'm just kidding, Buck. I'm going to meet with this captain and his daughter, so don't feel obligated to come over."
"Well, I'm already here," he said.
"Oh.
But that's all right. I've got plenty to do. It was good to see you again, and next time you come through New York..."
"Buck, I don't want you to feel obligated to entertain me."
"I don't."
"Sure you do. You're a nice guy, but it's obvious we're not kindred spirits. Thanks for seeing me, and especially for introducing me to Mr. Carpathia."
"Hattie, I could use a favor. Would it be possible to introduce me to this captain? I'd like to interview him. Is he staying overnight?"
"I'll ask him. You should meet his daughter anyway. She's a doll."
"Maybe I'll interview her, too."
"Yeah, good approach.
Just ask him, Hattie, please."
Rayford wondered if Hattie had a date with Buck Williams that evening. The right thing to do would be to invite her to dinner at his and Chloe's hotel. Now she was waving him over to the payphone. "Rayford, Buck Williams wants to meet you. He's doing a story and wants to interview you."
"Really? Me?" he said. "About what?"
"I don't know. I didn't ask. I suppose about flying or the disappearances. You were in the air when it happened."
"Tell him sure. I'll see him. In fact, why don't you ask him to join the three of us for dinner tonight if you're free?"
Hattie stared at Rayford as if she had been tricked into something. "Come on, Hattie. You and I will talk this afternoon, then we'll all get together for dinner at 6 at the Carlisle."
She turned back to the phone and told Buck.
"Where are you now?" she asked.
She paused.
"You're not."
Hattie peeked around the corner, laughed, and waved. Covering the mouthpiece, she turned to Rayford.
"That's him, right there on the portable phone."
"Well, why don't you both hang up and you can make the introductions?" Rayford said. Hattie and Buck hung up, and Buck tucked his phone away as he entered. "He's with us," Rayford told the woman at the desk. He shook Buck's hand. "So you're the writer for Global Weekly who was on my plane?"
"That's me," Buck said.
"What do you want to interview me about?"
"Your take on the disappearances. I'm doing a cover story on the theories behind what happened, and it would be good to get your perspective as a professional and as someone who was right in the middle of the turmoil when it happened."
"What an opportunity," Rayford thought.
"Happy to," he said.
"You can join us for dinner, then?"
"You bet,"
Buck said.
"And this is your daughter?"
Buck was stunned. He loved Chloe's name, her eyes, her smile. She looked directly at him and gave a firm handshake, something he liked in a woman. So many women felt it was feminine to offer a limp hand.
"What a beautiful girl," he thought.
He had been tempted to tell Captain Steele that, as of the next day, he would no longer be just a writer, but would become executive editor. But he feared that would sound like bragging, not complaining, so he had said nothing.
"Look," Hattie said, "the captain and I need a few minutes, so why don't you two get acquainted, and we'll all get back together later. Do you have time, Buck?"
"I do now," he thought.
"Sure," he said, looking at Chloe and her father. "Is that all right with you two?"
The captain seemed to hesitate, but his daughter looked at him expectantly. She was clearly old enough to make her own decisions, but apparently she didn't want to make things awkward for her dad.
"It's okay," Captain Steele said hesitantly. "We'll be in here."
"I'll stash my bag and we'll just take a walk in the terminal," Buck said. "If you want to, Chloe."
She smiled and nodded. It had been a long time since Buck had felt awkward and shy around a girl. As he and Chloe strolled and talked, he didn't know where to look and was self-conscious about where to put his hands. Should he keep them in his pockets or let them hang free? Let them swing?
Would she rather sit down or people watch or window shop? He asked her about herself and where she went to college, what she was interested in. She told him about her mother and her brother, and he sympathized. Buck was impressed at how smart and articulate and mature she seemed. This was a girl he could be interested in, but she had to be at least 10 years younger than he was. She wanted to know about his life and career. He told her anything she asked, but little more. Only when she asked if he had lost anybody in the vanishings did he tell her about his family in Tucson and his friends in England. Naturally, he said nothing about the Stonegal or Todd Cothran connections. When the conversation lulled, Chloe caught him gazing at her, and he looked away. When he looked back, she was looking at him. They smiled shyly. "This is crazy," he thought. He was dying to know if she had a boyfriend, but he wasn't about to ask. Her questions were more along the lines of a young person asking a veteran professional about his career. She envied his travel and experience. He pooh-poohed it, assuring her she would tire of that kind of a life. "Ever been married?" she asked. He was glad she had asked. He was happy to tell her no, that he had never really been serious enough with anyone to be engaged. "How about you?" he asked, feeling the discussion was now fair game. "How many times have you been married?" She laughed. "Only had one steady. When I was a freshman in college, he was a senior. I thought it was love, but when he graduated, I never heard from him again." "Literally?" "He went on some kind of an overseas trip, sent me a cheap souvenir, and that was the end of it. He's married now." "His loss." "Thank you." Buck felt bolder. "What was he, blind?" She didn't respond. Buck mentally kicked himself and tried to recover. "I mean, some guys don't know what they have." She was still silent, and he felt like an idiot. "How can I be so successful at some things and such a klutz at others?" he wondered. She stopped in front of a gourmet bakery shop. "You feel like a cookie?" she asked.
"Why, do I look like one?"
"How did I know that was coming?" she said. "Buy me a cookie and I'll let that groaner die a natural death."
"Of old age, you mean," he said.
Now that was funny. Rayford was as earnest, honest, and forthright with Hattie as he had ever been. They sat across from each other in overstuffed chairs in the corner of a large, noisy room where they could not be heard by anyone else. "Hattie," he said, "I'm not here to argue with you or even to have a conversation. There are things I must tell you, and I want you just to listen."
"I don't get to say anything, because there may be things I'll want you to know, too."
"Of course I'll let you tell me anything you want, but this first part, my part, I don't want to be a dialogue. I have to get some things off my chest, and I want you to get the whole picture before you respond, okay?"
She shrugged. "I don't see how I have a choice."
"You had a choice, Hattie. You didn't have to come."
"I didn't really want to come. I told you that, and you left that guilt trip message begging me to meet you here."
Rayford was frustrated. "You see what I didn't want to get into," he said. "How can I apologize when all you want to do is argue about why you're here?"
"You want to apologize, Rayford? I would never stand in the way of that."
She was being sarcastic, but he had gotten her attention. "Yes, I do. Now will you let me?" She nodded.